Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. While the domestic game here in England is getting set to start the new season after the briefest of off-season breaks, our focus this month will be on not on the top-tier Premier League, but on the Football League instead, discussing the current state of affairs with financial peril lurking at every turn. We're going to look at the sustainability of the existing structure, particularly in the environment we find ourselves in at the moment. And we'll delve into salary cap structure changes, transfer system and more. And joining me today to help me go through it all are another set of excellent guests, as always. First up is a regular voice on the Lob podcast, our Spanish resident Chelsea fan, whose club may have been ever present in the Premier League, but go back to the 1980s and they spent a good few seasons on and off in the second tier. Gary Thacker, welcome to the pod. I'm sure you recall those days away from the top flight.
I certainly do. And I remember that for a few weeks we nearly got relegated to the third tier of English football. So, yeah, you know, it can happen to anybody. And I remember, you know, Liverpool title winners this season. I remember Liverpool were a bang ordinary second tier team, Manchester United the same thing. So nothing's forever, guys. And, you know, top teams need to really take into account the plight of lower league teams because we all get there sometimes.
Very true indeed. And I speak from personal experience. We get there more often than some others. representing Merseyside today, we've got Evertonian Paul McParland. Now, your club may not have been out of the top tier in quite a long time, Paul, but I know you're also a keen observer of the fortunes of clubs in your part of the country in both Football League and indeed in non-league football. Welcome to the pod, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Aidan. Yeah, thanks for having the show tonight. And yeah, I mean, no, apart from supporting Everton, I do watch my local non-league team, Marine, who are like three levels below the National League now. And also been across Ross Tranmere, Wigan Athletic and Preston North End quite a few times last season as well. So yeah, I'm a football fan as well as an Everton fan.
Broad horizons and stuff. And for a slightly more up-to-date experience of life in the Championship, we've got Birmingham City fan Matthew Gibbs joining us again today. Welcome back, Matthew. How's things with you?
Oh, thanks for having me back on. I'm glad to be here. And to be honest, the less we talk about Birmingham City, the better. This is a safe place. We don't need to talk about that.
Well, I can't promise that entirely, but, you know, we might go easy. So today we're discussing the future of the Football League. But I think to start things off on that front, we need to look at the current state of affairs. So we lost Berry last season. We've now got Charlton Athletic facing an uncertain future. Macclesfield dropped out of League Two after a late points deduction. Wigan dropped a division under similar points penalty, thanks to ownership issues. So, I mean, Gary, leaving aside the COVID situation for a moment, this perilous financial state is something that's been occurring for several years now. It's not just a new thing. Is this a situation that was increasing, though, even pre-COVID, do you think?
I guess the short answer is yes, but it certainly isn't a new thing. I mean, I'm honest to remember Accrington Stanley dropping out of the Football League and even Nelson, I think, a few years before that. So it's not new, but it is worryingly it's increasing, you know. I think there was Maidstone in not too distant future. Sorry, not too distant past. But it's not a new phenomenon, but certainly the modern, the last few years have sort of increased the pressure on lower league clubs. I hate the phrase lower league clubs, you know, because they're, you know, we're talking about teams that are one or two leagues away from the absolute top tier English football, and there's probably 1,700 leagues below them. So they're not lower league, but they're sort of, you know, not in the top tier of the English league pyramid. But the pressure's on him increasing massively, and certainly the situation with COVID has just accelerated the problems massively.
Okay, Paul, on the back of what Gary's saying there, I mean, Premier League clubs, it's a similar situation of potential mismanagement, I guess, but they get away with it in terms of the sheer amount of money incoming. Whereas for Football League clubs, especially as you get further down the pyramid, it has a greater impact, I guess. So do you think some clubs are being mismanaged to the point of irresponsibility?
I think as Gary indicated before, Aidan, I think it always has been the case that there has been mismanagement at this level. You know, Gary mentioned Maidstone United going bust. I think Aldershot went bust as well, didn't they, at one stage? So it's not that unusual. But I think it boils down, from my perspective, to more the issue of, you know, this right and proper person's test for taking over a club, because certainly the scenario that happened at Wigan Athletic really should never, ever have come to pass that way. I mean, how can one person buy a club and then set it on somebody else without the Football League having been involved or being able to do anything about that? So I think the situation has been quite chaotic. I think, you know, whether we, for the future, we're looking for the model whereby there's more, a greater percentage of fan ownership within clubs, maybe more community involvement within clubs, you know, as per the German model, I don't know. But I think you can't have the situation where, you know, like St Macclesfield, the owner's not paying the wages, the club ends up getting demoted from the Football League because of the financial mismanagement side. And the only people who lose out in this circumstance are the fans and the players, who are always the victims of such monumental misownership of various clubs in the lower leagues. So I think the way forward has to be a proper assessment of who these owners are, and maybe even, I don't know, have a trial period to see whether it's working properly or not, and maybe some sort of a contingency scheme where the Football League can take over a club for 3 months or so whilst a new buyer is found or something. Because, you know, Wigan Athletic in particular, it's just been awful what's happened to them this season, and I wouldn't wish what's happened upon Wigan to happen to any other club. And I know Matthew might be able to give us some details on Birmingham, because I know you have some quite bizarre owners of Birmingham at the moment, and I do worry about what a read about what goes on there as well.
Well, do you want to jump in there, Matthew? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I don't know where to start. owners in the Football League, I think it's easier to count on one hand, like, the number of well-run clubs. Like, football seems to attract all these, I don't even know what the right word is, like, these outlandish figures who treat football and just, well, they just run roughshod over football clubs in Britain. In terms of Birmingham, I mean, we've had our fair share of terrible owners going back to, like, the 90s. More recently, I mean, after we won the League Cup, our owner during that time was Carson Young, who eventually ended up in prison. So we had a period of time where we were owned by a guy in prison in Hong Kong. And the clubs, I think I'm right in saying that it sort of reverted. It was owned for a period of time by the Hong Kong police until it was then sold on to who we have now, who... Well, I mean, we don't actually know who owns us now. There's lots of rumours. There's lots of special reports were done by The Athletic and other sort of journalistic bodies. And who exactly owns us is a bit of a mystery, to be honest. And then, yeah, it's a lot of clubs in the Championship especially, that they sort of have to balance. It's balancing running a viable business with, you know, showing a bit of ambition in inverted commas to get to the Premier League. And like one bad summer, like we had that one bad summer under Redknapp where we spent 25 million and, you know, something like 120% of our income went on wages, and it crushed us, crippled us for the next few years. So we've had like 5 relegation battles in a row. It's as you say, it comes down to a lot of things, but, you know, the fit and proper test where they just sort of allow any old owner into own clubs and treat them like playthings is it's pretty embarrassing. It's pretty terrible.
I mean, Matthew, coming in on that, do you actually know how this test works? I have no idea what the checkpoints are that they look at. You know, what's the criteria that they go through, and how bad do you have to be to fail this?
Well, that's the thing. I think, like, especially when you look at Wigan, there were inquiries made before I don't know the name of the owners, but before they took over Wigan, and they made inquiries about putting the club administration.
Yeah. That's
and
right.
Yet it still went ahead and still...
It did. I mean, wouldn't that ring massive alarm bells in any other business model apart from football?
I mean, talking about football as a business model is, I think it must be one of the weirdest industries out there. I mean, you look at some of the numbers and about how, like, it's impossible to run a financially viable and financially profitable football club. It's next to impossible. So, yeah, we're all in here to talk about this, but it all boils down to me just going, I don't know, I don't understand.
If I could just jump in for a second there, Aidan. I mean, it's interesting to hear what Matthew says about it being impossible to run a successful football club financially in the Championship. And I understand exactly what he's saying, and I think the problem is that, and I'm not talking about Birmingham here, I'm not just Birmingham fan, I'm not talking about Birmingham, any particular Championship club or even League One, League Two club. But fans always demand, we just need somebody to come in and invest money in the club. What they mean is I want somebody to come in and buy some players so we can get promoted and get success. The problem is with that is that in terms of promotion, there's only going to be three clubs who are going to get promoted out of a league of 24. So 21 are going to fail. Of that 21, three are going to get relegated as well. And so that investment, from the majority of, if people do put that investment, you know, I'm not talking about the Wiggins and the Buries and Charlton Athletic of this world, who are tragic stories. But there's only so much success to go around. It's the same in the Premier League. You know, there's only so many trophies to go around, and success is defined, it should be defined in different ways. And whether that means being stable in that league and building up gradually over a period of time. And I use this sort of example just to compare it to Sevilla in Spain, who have got this have employed a director of football, Monchi, who's brilliant in the transfer market, who have turned a profit over the last few years, been successful, won European titles, but didn't try to do it in 2 years. They built up over 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And I think the problem is fans and owners expect, well, not so much owners, but certainly fans expect success tomorrow. And it doesn't work like that in any business, not just football. It doesn't work like that in any business.
Yeah, I'd agree, Gary. I think, but as a fan, you always want the best for your team, don't you?
Of course you do, mate. Of course you do.
Yeah. I think as well.
Isn't always instant success, though, Paul.
No, yeah, I mean, sadly, most fans would prefer temporary success to no success at all, though, which is, you know, quite a bizarre state of affairs. But as reflecting back about this, because I think part of it is, I think part of the issue is that, in terms of how it's marketed, I mean, to me, the Championship is one of the most exciting leagues in Europe. I think on the last day of the season last year, like 18 out of 24 clubs had something to play for. I remember following the scores on the final day and the positions were changing second by second. It's a fascinating competition. Yet the way the Championship is covered in the media, on the TV and in the press, it's almost non-existent. It's almost an afterthought. And there are some brilliant clubs in the Championship with a long tradition and history of success at higher levels. And I just think, in terms of the model within the Championship, I think they should be getting far more, or demanding far more for the TV rights possibly, and also, you know, getting better sponsorship deals and trying to create more interest in the Championship as a product.
Yeah, when you're right, I'd love to agree with that, what you said there, Paul. Certainly the Championship is a massively competitive league and has been for the past 6, 7, 8, perhaps 10 years or so. But I think the problem is that the desire to watch the Premiership isn't as large as it is to watch the Championship isn't as large as it is to watch the Premier League. I'm not saying that's nice. I'm just saying that's true. Sorry, Matthew.
No, I totally agree with what you're saying. I think it all goes back to this is when I was growing up. I'm going to show my age here, but this is when I was growing up. But the ITV digital crash, and yeah. I think a lot of clubs are still suffering from that. I know Barnsley at the time went out of business because of what happened with that, and there's a lot of clubs like further down in League One, League Two who have suffered massively with that, and it's taken a long time to get back on even footing, because it's like you say, you can't build up success over day, but in a day, but if you get knocked down, it takes years to come back as well. And then we have like sort of the Premier League and the supposed drip down from the Premier League riches, which doesn't really exist. Because I think I mentioned this on the last pod I was on, but like 70% of the 400 million the Premier League gives to the EFL is in parachute payments, which means it goes to the recently relegated clubs, meaning that the sort of disparity and the huge gap between the bottom of the Championship and the top just gets bigger and bigger. And then that means, you know, the bottom of the Championship to League One gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And It's just the model is completely unsustainable and really tilted towards the bigger teams in the Premier League and in the Championship.
If we talk a little bit also as well as the Championship, and I mean, what Paul is saying there is absolutely spot on in terms of the product. I mean, the Premier League likes to market itself as, you know, anyone can beat anybody, but it's the Championship where that's actually the most true rather than the Premier League. But if you go down a notch or two, so Leagues 1 and 2, we're talking about the money. So the Championship's obviously got the huge parachute payments you're mentioning there. Leagues 1 and 2 have voted to implement a salary cap, going forward now. So that's obviously causing a bit of controversy. We've got a question on this from one of our regulars as well, Lewis, who's saying that the PFA are angered about this, saying it's unlawful and unenforceable, but with the finances of many clubs less than stable, particularly in the current situation. What are our thoughts about that proposal? I mean, basically, as well as the PFA against it, some of the larger clubs at that level too, the likes of Sunderland, Ipswich and so on, who obviously generate vastly more levels of income than, say, Accrington and Fleetwood and clubs like that, which they should be able to invest in their teams, of course. But is this a sort of necessary measure, a necessary bit of financial sense, given generally clubs' apparent inability at times to live within their means? After all, if clubs go bust, the players lose their jobs, don't they? So, you know, it doesn't work without clubs at least attempting to remain within their means to some degree. What are our thoughts on the salary cap?
Well, I'll jump in and stick my head above the parapet first. Salary caps are fine in theory, and they're also fine within a locked environment. So, for example, if the Championship or League One or League Two was a locked environment, no club's going to get relegated, no club's going to get promoted. It would work perfectly. The problem is that teams will go out of that league and come into that league. And so therefore it becomes difficult to enforce, because if a club's come down from the Premier League, sorry, from the Championship into League One, where there was no salary cap, have they suddenly got to get rid of all their players? It just becomes a difficult situation. And therefore what will happen is that all that club's best players will be pirated away by clubs who haven't got a salary cap and were in the same league in the Championship the year before. I'm just going to give you sort of a rough example, a metaphor for a sporting metaphor. The Rugby Union Premier League introduced a salary cap 2 years ago, I think maybe 3 years ago, and lost all their best players, but lost tranches of their best players to the French Rugby Union League, where there was no salary cap. Yeah. So in a closed environment, like in American Major League Baseball, there's a salary cap. But it's a closed environment. Everybody's sticking to the same rules. It works. In an open pyramid of promotion, relegation, or where players could be transferred abroad, which is an even sort of more complicated issue in this situation, I just don't think it's feasible.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So you get it. I think you made those points really well. And the comparison with the rugby union situation is really, you know, it's pretty poignant one. That one, it gets the points across really well. I mean, on principle, I'm with the PFA on this. I don't think you should be able to limit the footballers' wages. I just don't think that's fair by any stretch of the imagination. It's up to clubs to budget their finances accordingly. It's up to owners to. I mean, part of the problem, in my view, with owners is that some of them have been quite successful businessmen, but the lousy leaders in football, they just don't apply the same principles that they applied in their business, their football ownership. The other thing that concerns me as well is, for argument's sake, so somebody wins the National League, which doesn't have a salary cap, and they've attracted good players to come and play for them, so they get promoted to League Two. Are those good players then going to lead because the club then has put a salary cap into place? I'm just not quite sure how that would work. And I just think, you know, I hate to use the phrase the survival of the strongest and the fittest, but you know, if you're supportive of the clubs you mentioned before, Portsmouth, Sunderland, Ipswich, you know, even Bradford City in League Two, generating, you know, massive attendances each week, shouldn't you be able to benefit from those attendances and use the money as you see fit rather than being restricted by a salary cap?
Yeah, well, I quite agree. You ought to be able to. I mean, after all, that's how clubs at every other level progress, don't they? You know, those that are the bigger clubs, it's the way of things. The bigger clubs generate more income, therefore they're able to invest more and improve. And those that are temporarily in those lower leagues, you know, they should have the means to get themselves out. Matthew, yeah, have you got anything to add?
Yeah, I think I agree in the most part. I agree with, I think Andy Holt, you know, the guy who owns Accrington, who he seems like one of the good guys of football right down the lower leagues. He wrote an article in, I want to say, the Telegraph, where he said that it's kind of, it will result in fewer failures. And I think while we are having football for the next season at a time when no fans can go to the stadium and, you know, the gate receipts, the food, the drinks, all that sort of match day experience, all that adds up to about it's like half of League One and League Two clubs' income. At a time when you have to be a bit more careful with the finances, I can see why it got brought in. I think it should have been weighted, like what we said. Like I don't know how. I'm going to show my ignorance about financial talk here, but like it should have been weighted so maybe Sunderland and Portsmouth can have a bit of a higher salary cap than the teams who bring in less money.
So as a percentage of turnover, for example.
Exactly. Like Fleetwood and Lincoln City. So I think if it was weighted, it would make a bit more sense. But at a time when you know the money involved is, well, there's no money involved in football at the minute, and if this is a measure that can be introduced and is likely to get voted out anyway next season, I think it will result in fewer failures, and it will save a lot more clubs, so we'll have less clubs going out of business over the next year, I think.
It's just interesting what you said about the percentage of turnover. Isn't that exactly what the financial fair play theory is supposed to be about?
Yes.
I rest my case.
But of course, if we add COVID into this mix, many clubs in further down the pyramid and going into non-league, which Paul will be able to talk about as well with his experiences at Marine, they rely heavily, of course, on their match day revenue in a way that top league teams simply don't. So there's much smaller TV revenue, as we've already mentioned, particularly in Leagues 1 and 2, which is in actual fact, it's lower TV revenue than the National League teams actually receive. From their coverage. It's the match day money that keeps these clubs going day to day. And with no crowds in attendance since late March, many clubs are, of course, facing troubled times. So, Paul, you can jump in here with your experiences of how things are now at Marine. But I guess the overall question is, are we going to see an increased regularity of clubs suffering administration or worse as a result of the current situation?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable, Aidan, unless clubs start to think a lot more creatively. Marine have had 2 weeks of friendly matches now. They've had four games in succession. And I have to say, I've been quite impressed with the organisation. For the first two games, they played Southwells and FC United, and the gate was limited to 200, and you had to apply online to get your tickets, so they had your contact details. And that aspect of it worked fine, and both those games were sold out, incidentally, as well. They played another game this Saturday. Yesterday, I went to see Marine play Chester, and for the games in September, the crowd limit was increased to 400, and I think they sold 375 tickets, and they were charging £8 a ticket with no concessions. So I think financially, they've actually made quite a bit of money this season as well. From the friendly matches, probably more than what they would have done for normal home games, bearing in mind lots of people getting on concessionary discounts for those matches. So I think the whole process worked really well. The track and trace worked well, hand sanitizers you go in. Every second row of the stand was sealed off, and there was absolutely no problem with it at all. And I think speaking to people there, everyone's just glad to be back watching football. I mean, I don't know about yourselves, but it's the longest period in my life I've gone without watching live football games, so it just felt great to be back. And I've thrown something a bit more controversial here. Apparently, one of the things that made Marine a lot of money, which they've only started recently, is you could buy a drink and drink from your pint glass watching the game on the terraces. And I know for the last home game, they made more than £1,000 purely in terms of bar receipts. And to me, this begs a bigger question about, is one way forward for lower league teams that maybe you can have a drink whilst you're watching the game in Leagues 1 and Leagues 2 as an experiment? Because I keep reading that football's a lot more middle class these days, that it's a much more fan base. Yet we still can't drink at football matches. I went to Edinburgh 2 years ago to watch Scotland play the All Blacks. I could have had 10 pints when I was watching the game with everyone. The following Sunday, the next day, I went to watch Hart, and you can't get a drink inside the stadium. What's going on here? You know, why are football fans still demonised that they still are not trusted to have a drink when they're watching the match?
Yeah, I've regularly gone along to the rugby here, Newcastle Falcons, and I've seen England games and various things. And yes, you can happily sup away on a giant two-pinter, which you can't do anywhere at a football game. And it's largely the same people to some extent. I know it's not entirely true, but there's a huge crossover. It's a big cross-section.
So it's worth mentioning, if I can just chuck in here, that over here, that's not a problem. Yeah. In Spain, it's not an issue. You can drink. This crazy thing they used to have, and I'm not sure if it's still true, because I haven't been to a Premier League ground for quite a while, that they used to have hatched areas by the stairs where if you've got a glass of beer, you cut a plastic glass, I should add, of course, you can't stand this hatched area, because if you could see grass and have a glass of beer in your hand, you apparently will turn psychotic. The logic is lost on me, but there you are. But certainly over here in Spain, I think every level, I think it's true. You can be allowed to take beer into watch game, because why the hell not? You know, as Paul said, and it's a really good point. You know, and you know, Paul's really good at sort of looking at these sort of things from a sort of I would say different point of view, but a certain reasonable point of view is probably the best way of phrasing it. You know, it works, it can work really well at lower league grounds, certainly League One, League Two, and you know, non-league. Why the hell not? You're not going to get people going sort of. You're not going to get gangs of hooligans like you perhaps you might have got in the sort of 70s and 80s. Going to watch, Wrexham play Stockport County. I mean, it's probably not going to happen. So why not allow clubs to have this as a revenue and other similar things? I mean, as in typical Paul McFarland that way, perfect sense, buddy. Perfect sense.
Thanks, Gary. I'll buy you a drink afterwards.
No worries, mate. I've got one already.
Well, in this financial environment, then, and again, I think this goes beyond the current COVID situation, is the existing league structure sustainable given the financial situation of many football league clubs? I mean, Matthew, what do you think? I mean, this can go beyond the football league as well. The league below, the National League, of course, is mostly professional at the highest level of non-league, with all the travel and financial costs that entails. What are your thoughts about changes to the structure of the football league and whether that would be appropriate, whether that would help in the current situation or going forwards in terms of clubs and their finances and their sort of running costs?
I think changes have to happen. I think the pandemic has acted a bit like, I think I said this before, but the pandemic has acted a bit like VAR when it shows that a lot of things in society don't work how they should, or, you know, things are broken, and the pandemic has shone a light on that. So now, you know, we went a couple of months without football and clubs are broken, like they're scrapping around for revenue and there's nothing going. That's not a viable way to run a business. And then when you look at some of the numbers involved in football, I was doing some reading about this earlier, and there's some absurd scenarios where overall revenues in the Championship increased to 785 million during the 18-19 campaign. But the wage bills rose as well to 837 million. Like, just in the Championship alone, it means that clubs are spending 107% of their income on wages, which means that they're stretching themselves to breaking point, crippling themselves in the sort of rush to get promoted. And I'd like to echo what was said earlier, that I think part of the problem is that clubs regulate themselves. You know, the Football League, they vote on regulations, on the sort of upcoming rules. So the salary cap was voted in by clubs. And the problem with this is that we know the majority of owners can't be trusted to run clubs responsibly, you know, because the law of promotion, riches, is too tempting to turn down, and they think it's within their grasp so they can go for it. So the problem then is that self-regulation doesn't work when these people won't vote in measures themselves, if that makes sense. To echo what we said earlier, I think it's clear that the EFL at the minute is not fit for purpose, really.
Yeah, Matthew makes some really good points there, Aidan. You know, it's important to sort of note, and you know, there's the argument about regionalisation of the Championship, and certainly League One and League Two. But you know, you can sort of, there's three sort of positions you can take on these sort of things. That, you know, so you get utterly convinced it's right, utterly convinced it's wrong, or I'm yet to be convinced. And I think I sit in that I'm yet to be convinced section, because if Matthew's figures are correct, and I'm sure they are, the massive cost of football clubs in the Championship isn't travel. It's not cost of travelling from, you know, Plymouth to Carlisle, however large that will be. It's wages, and regionalisation of the league ain't going to change that anytime soon. The issue that they need to get a hold of is to run the club within the bounds of normal financial management. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, when successful business people take over a football club, all of a sudden the things that they've done to make their business successful seem to go out the window. And they take crazy financial risks because that's just the way it's done. And the problem is just the way it's done is brought us to the situation we're in now.
What about other adjustments to structure, though? So it doesn't just have to be regionalization. I mean, that's one that's obviously been talked about a lot. But other models that might be considered could be just simply smaller leagues. So you don't have as many games, therefore you don't need as many players in your squad, perhaps, and therefore the overall salary costs come down as a result.
The problem with that is that the calculation is the marginal cost or profit in undertaking a football match. At the moment, football clubs want to take more and more and more games because they perceive them as being more. They're going to make more money from more games. So if you reduce the games, by definition, from their point of view, they're going to produce less money. Not so the profits will go down or the losses will increase, whichever way you look at the balance sheet. that's not a solution.
I think that's right, Gary. And going back to what you said before, Aidan, about the regionalisation, I'm not particularly in favour of it, but I can see an argument for combining League Two and the National League and making those two regional leagues rather than just the two national leagues that they are at the moment, whether there's any mileage in that. Because I think as well, Stephen Scragg mentioned when we spoke about this a while ago about the National League has negotiated its own TV deal with live games on every week, so they're getting a lot more TV income from that. Now, whether if they then combine with League Two, that could be a whole new TV market possibly for clubs right down at the lower end of the structure. I don't know. I just think it's something worth considering. And the other thing about the restructure as well. I mean, am I right to think that Rick Parry is in charge of the EFL at the moment, and he was the driving force behind the formation of the Premier League?
Yes, I believe that's right. Yeah.
So I'm there thinking, well, surely with his background, he should be the man to be able to, to do something in terms of the. He's obviously good. He was obviously successful in creating that competition, and maybe he needs to look at the whole structure of the Football League to see maybe along Gary's lines that there's less teams in each division, because whether you can justify having 24 teams in League One, League Two, and the Championship, I'm not quite sure anymore. Maybe for the Championship, sitting off League One, League Two, I don't think. And the other thing that occurred to me as well was, I mean, the Football League offices are based in Preston. I mean, you kind of think, well, if you want to be marketing yourself, you want to be selling the product more, shouldn't it be based somewhere like Manchester or Leeds or Liverpool or London?
Yeah, and it's a slight oddity, I guess, isn't it? It harks back to a bygone age if you think Preston has been the hub of all that. And Matthew, what are your thoughts on this little section of the debate?
Yeah, I think an important event that happened in the last few months was when the pandemic first hit and all the leagues were deciding whether to stop or to carry on. I think a weirdly pivotal moment was when the Championship decided to continue playing in line with the Premier League. Yeah. I think it's really, really clear that they're trying to tie themselves more closely to the Premier League, trying to reap the benefit of the huge TV deals that the Premier League get. And they're trying to sort of not distance themselves, but it's clear that League One and League Two are sort of better together, are seeing themselves more tied together. And the Championship is trying to be more in line with the Premier League. So I really wouldn't be surprised, and especially with Rick Parry in charge of the Football League now, whether there might be a Premier League Two or something in the future where the Championship is turned into Premier League Two, and the League One and League Two sort of tie themselves a bit more closely to the National League, and they do maybe the regionalised leagues like we've mentioned.
What would be the impact of a Premier League Two on those clubs left behind then in Leagues One and Two and the National League?
It's a good question that I don't really know the answer to, I'll be honest. But I think we're seeing that sort of thing already when, the salary caps is going to go a long way. As much as I think it's a necessary evil in the short term, I think it could go a long way to pushing the Premier League too, where just because of the money involved, the limit on what salaries teams can offer, what transfers they can offer, that the League One and League Two start to look a little bit more like the National League. I can see that happening. I don't know about what you guys think.
Can I just ask a question? I mean, it's a good question you asked there, Aidan, about what would be the effect on leagues, on the clubs in League One and Two. The question in my mind is, what would be the effects on the clubs that in the now relabeled Premier League 2, because other than being called a different name, I don't see what difference it makes. If there's a belief that more money would come down from Premier League 1, I'm backing that yet to be convinced situation. I'm not sure what calling the Championship Premier League 2, what difference would it make?
I reckon they'd see it more as like a PR opportunity, wouldn't they? It's not so much being about the second league, but just like tying themselves more closely to the Premier League.
In financial terms or sort of, you know, success terms, shall we say, in real terms, I suppose what I'm asking is, what difference would it make? I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to be smarter. I just genuinely don't know. I'm happy to be convinced of what the difference would make.
It's one of those things that I know I've heard bandied around before, and I can, it's, you know, those things where I can see it happening. I don't necessarily think it's a good thing. I think a negative in the long run, but I can see, you know, people in charge of these big corporations thinking that's a great idea and then rolling with it and regretting it later.
The only thing I could envisage would be in terms of negotiating the TV deal. So currently the Championship is obviously the biggest football league player when it comes to that deal, but it's small fry compared to the Premier League TV deal, whereas they'd be, I guess, clinging on to the Premier League coattails for that TV deal. Whether they actually gain from that is another matter, because you know, they'd be the minor partner, of course. They still wouldn't be as many viewers for a Championship match as there would be for a Premier League match, you would imagine. Although depending on certain clubs, that may be different. But that's the only thing I can envisage would actually be the financial benefit.
Yeah, forgive me for being typical. I just can't see it making that much difference. And you know, if it's Sheffield Wednesday playing, I can't think of the Championship club. It doesn't matter who they are. Sheffield Wednesday playing, I don't know, Fulham. Oh, hunger for a pro team. It doesn't matter. Two Championship teams playing each other, whether they're called Championship teams or PL teams, does it make a difference? Are people going to pay more just for a different label? Or Premier League clubs, what we call Premier League now, clubs, could be more inclined to share revenue?
I don't think they will, Gary. I don't think the Premier League would want to particularly share the largesse they're getting at the moment, particularly in the climate at the moment where you've got like the Chinese reneging on a TV deal, you know, with fans not being allowed in at the start of the season. That's going to hit the TV contract revenue as well. So I don't think at the moment the time is right for a Premier League 2, because I don't think the Premier League itself feels financially secure enough to go ahead with that prospect.
Good call, Paul.
Now, Paul, you mentioned fan ownership earlier. Now, ownership is obviously a big subject in the way clubs are run. Now, we've had one question on the Twitter site from John Dalby asking what our thoughts would be on smaller or lower league teams being owned by the bigger clubs. Now, that'd be a rather controversial move, to say the least. Not ideal, but it may save clubs. He's got mixed thoughts on it, but wondering whether it might change or affect the fortunes of some of the clubs who might be about to disappear out of existence, whether such a model would be something that may come along in the future, perhaps.
Well, possibly. I mean, personally, it doesn't really inspire me that as a model. I think you have to keep your lower league teams that independent. You know, I think people underestimate the prestige it gives you having a side in your local town who's still, you know, participate in the Football League. I mean, Gary, you grew up in Walsall, didn't you? And I'm sure, you know, Walsall, the fact the team was in the Football League was a great source of pride to the citizens of the town, particularly when you had those League Cup runs in the 80s and things like that.
Definitely, Paul. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, I agree with what you're saying entirely. I mean, the idea of fan ownership is wonderful. Don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely emotionally right with it. But I'm not sure what it would work in the real world. And I know some clubs have gone into fan ownership, and you know, I massively applaud the German model, works really well. But there's a sort of big difference between that having that in theory and making it work in practice. For instance, for instance, if a fan ownership took ownership of a Championship club and they want to get promoted to the Premier League, where would the finance come from? Yeah, I'm not saying this is a nice argument. I'm just saying this is the way the world is. It's not nice. It's just true. Fan ownership is a great idea, and lower level it will work far more successfully than as you go higher and higher through the pyramid, because the demands for financial investment becomes higher and higher as you go higher, and as you aspire to higher as well.
Of course, the German model with fan ownership, it's come from a different starting point to where we are now.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's the huge difference. So it is a sustainable model there from how it's evolved and developed in Germany. Whereas here, yes, of course, you've got the mega bucks and the huge oligarch owners and so on. It's not a position you can move from very easily.
If we just go back to the second part of that question as well. Living locally, I cannot see a situation where Tranmere Rovers fans would be happy being a Liverpool B team or an Everton B team, because they pride themselves on the fact as fans that they're from Birkenhead, not from Liverpool. I'm sure in your part of the world, Darlington fans would not want to be a Sunderland B team. Hartlepool fans would not want to be a Newcastle B team. I can see an argument for clubs having closer links with loan deals and things like that. But I think the lower league teams, to me, have to maintain their independence.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree, and I think it would be a far too controversial a step. Just look at the outcry when B teams were proposed in the Checker Trade Trophy or whatever it was called at the time, and the huge issues that has caused. But anyway, in terms of other revenue sources for league clubs, transfers, of course, obviously a big source of revenue. The further down the chain you go in terms of sustainability for clubs and so on. If there's an increase in the need to generate money, given match day income might be limited for a little while, do you think we might see clubs become increasingly desperate to offload their best players, potentially creating therefore a buyer's market, or do you see an impact on the transfer system in any other ways, given the current situation? Matthew, what would your thoughts be there?
I think the transfer market is, I think it'd be, it's, well, it is so weird this year. I think I read something silly that something like 10 billion euros have been wiped off the value of players because of the pandemic. I thought logically this means that clubs will spend less on transfers, because they have less money. And whether this means they opt for that their second or third choice target, or there's just a general decrease in transfer fees, I don't know. But I think the most interesting thing about this is the transfer fees already owed. Because I was reading about Bournemouth, and when they were relegated this year from the Premier League, not only is it a huge financial hit for them, but they still owe £80 million in existing deals, because the nature of modern-day football is that full frees don't get paid up front. It's usually spread out over months or years. So when they sold Nathan Ake to Manchester City for £40 million, that only covered half of their transfer debts. And are they even getting that in one go? Who knows? But it's a really complicated summer for a lot of teams. And especially now that FFP has been relaxed for a year, which, it barely kept teams in check in the first place. You'd think there's a PR element involved when it comes to spending huge sums of money in a pandemic while the rest of the country is struggling. Not that it seems to bother certain owners. But lower down the divisions, in League One and League Two, we're already seeing there's been a bit more of a cautious approach.
Do you think we might see clubs becoming potentially increasingly reliant on loans from wealthier clubs if they don't have the finances to buy? It would avoid, of course, the need to pay a player's full contract, less liability, therefore, perhaps financially, but it's less of a foundation on which to build a club and its team, of course. Paul, what are your thoughts there? Loans, obviously, it's becoming something that's a bit more widespread, with perhaps stockpiling of players at the top end of the game, and therefore needing to get these people games that they've farmed out on loan. And it's great for the Premier League clubs, but it's not a sustainable model for building a club at the lower level.
No, it certainly isn't, Aidan. I have a few sort of reservations about the whole loan system. I do worry about the effect it has on player development as well. You look at sort of the Arsenal keeper towards the end of this campaign, Martinez. He'd been out loan for about the last seven seasons with different clubs each time. I'm not sure how that benefits him as a player, being shunted around all the time. I'm not sure how it benefits the clubs just having him for one season as well. And in terms of the loan situation, I don't understand why we still have the ruling in the Premier League that if a Premier League loan from a fellow Premier League team, they can't play in the match against you when you play during the season, because I just think that unbalances the sort of a the fairness of the competition. I mean, I think Chelsea were notorious doing this three or four years ago, weren't they? Where they loaned out quite a few players who could then couldn't play against them in the return fixture in the Premier League.
You want to jump in there, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem we have with the this is the major problem for lower league clubs, and the transfer market. Excuse me, car going past my window. Transfer market in football is analogous to the housing market. When the economy is going well, housing become expensive. When it's not going so well, they become cheaper because people have less money. The COVID situation has put football in exactly the same situation. Well, it's not been putting it because it's always been the same situation, but has highlighted that it is in the same situation. So, for example, if a player that might have been transferred from a Championship club or a League One club, but a Championship to a Premier League or from League One to a Championship club, might have had a value of 10 million. That value now is 6 million. And it's not because the player's any worse, it's just that the value, the actual value, is deemed to be less. And the simple equation is this: anything is only worth what somebody will pay for it.
Yeah.
An estate agent will give you an idea of what your house is worth, but the actual reality of what your house is worth is what somebody will pay for it. And there's an example with this with Jude Bellingham, who left Matthew's club, Birmingham City, to go to Borussia Dortmund. And there's talk about, you know, 20, 50, 60 million pounds for this young lad. But the value of any player is only defined by what somebody will pay for it. And the problem for lower league clubs, sorry, forgive me if I use that term, I hate the term. The problem for non-Premier League clubs is when they sell players to a higher level club, the money they're getting now is far less than they would have got 2 years ago for the same player.
I'd agree with everything Gary said there. I think that the market will change because of the COVID experience, and when certain football's in demand, the price goes up, and when not, the price will go down. And I think it's... remember watching the Sunderland to Our Die documentary, which I'm sure you loved, Aidan, and I was looking at Jack Rodwell there, you know, a guy who was like draining money out of the club and refusing to leave and have his contract paid up, which would have really helped the club. And I think clubs need to look at the length of contracts that they offer players. I think there's a tendency, you know, for clubs desperate to get back in the so-called big time to offer a ridiculous length of contract to players who really don't deserve a contract half that length.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's ludicrous amounts of money. I mean, the super agents pushing things as well. I mean, there's certain clubs that are solely in the exclusive use of certain agents that are prospering that way, of course. But it's clubs have to learn to manage themselves slightly better in many ways, don't they? But there's one final thing on the sort of Football League discussion I want to mention is that once crowds do return, there's been potential talk about scrapping the 3 p.m. TV blackout as well. Now, if that does happen, will that have the impact on lower league attendances that the original rule was created to prevent? Matthew, what are your thoughts there?
I like to think that the 3 p.m. blackout is just a temporary thing for this season, while people aren't allowed in the stadium, and when things go back to normal, whenever that might be, then they'll probably... I really hope they'll introduce the 3 p.m. blackout again. I think there's been clear results that it helps. Like, it helps with gate receipts, like, especially further down the division, further down the pyramid. But while we're on, I just want to add something about match day experiences, because I have a feeling that I think it could be like a long, long time before we see like full stadiums again. And I think this is due... I think the pandemic has like exacerbated the situation, but I think these are problems from before, because like football crowds are getting older. Younger people are being priced out of going to the football, I think. And now we have this situation where younger people, a lot of them have lost jobs. No one's got any money. How are they going to be able to afford to go to see the football? Like, who's going to have football after this pandemic is over? Who's going to have money to go see the football? And then there's another sort of added safety element. When will people feel safe enough to go be surrounded by tens of thousands of people, you know, after what the country, the world has just been through? So, I don't know, I hope the 3 p.m. blackout is temporary. And also, I think it could be like a long, long time before we see full stadiums again, regardless.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Matthew. I think that's a really accurate analysis of where we are at the moment. And I like your point about younger fans being priced out. And we might be in a situation where the older elements of the sport might not want to go back inside the stadiums because of their fears about COVID. Because I think there's been this unwritten assumption that everyone will want to go back to watch football again. And I think there's a minority still of fans who are really going to think twice about whether they want to go back to that same experience again once we come out of this. And I think until until a vaccine has been discovered, I think there will be certain more vulnerable members of society who think twice about going inside a football stadium again in the current climate. Did you see the thing in the press as well about Tottenham Hotspur asking for permission to have 4,000 fans in for the Everton game next Sunday, but only the fans who paid the highest fees for their tickets are the ones they want in the ground. Now, to me, that is just so outrageous. It's absolutely untrue and goes against everything that, you know, I believe in as a football supporter. I really hope that doesn't come to pass. And going back to what you said, Matthew, about the 3 o'clock kickoff, I agree totally. If that 3 o'clock blanket ban on live football does not continue, I can see non-league teams really, really struggling to survive because, you know, even myself, if I'm at home Saturday afternoon and I can watch, I don't know, say Newcastle against Leeds, or I can go and watch, it's pouring down with rain outside, but Marina playing Droylsden, it's going to be a tough call for me now, I'm afraid.
The guys make really good points there, and, you know, I agree with absolutely everything they're saying. You know, Matthew makes some very pertinent points as well, and you know, the only thing I'd say is, you know, I'm missing going to live football myself, and the club we go and watch here, which is about, I don't know, a quarter of a mile away from our apartment here, social distancing wouldn't be an issue because if there's 50 people to watch them, that's a mega crowd. So, you know, I'd feel safe.
Well, I guess a final point on fans returning to stadiums, I mean, this is something that's been discussed with regards to Newcastle United in this area, is that going to games is a habit, it's a habitual act. But given how long people have not been going for now, they've got out of that habit to some extent. Some people have, not everybody, of course, would feel this way. But some people, especially when the actual value and entertainment on offer is, shall we say, limited, when it comes to certain clubs, and Newcastle are very much in that category, lack of ambition, people have developed other things to do. They may have realised, even if it's just simply a case of, you know, walking the dog for a few hours on a Saturday afternoon, but that turns out to be more fulfilling and rewarding than going to the match and suffering a dire show for the huge sums you have to fork out to do it. I think, as well as those who are not wanting to return for safety reasons, there may be a number, and who knows how many it actually is, but in certain areas, in certain clubs, there may be a number of people who just simply realise there are better things to do with their spare time. And we'll see how that goes, of course. But I mean, overall, in terms of the Football League, I mean, thanks for all your points there. It's a brilliant discussion. I mean, there's a situation that may become increasingly troublesome, of course, for some clubs as the current situation unfolds over the coming months, years, and however long it all lasts. Hopefully we'll be able to avoid situations like that of Bury recently, but who knows. But at the other end of the football scale, vastly at the other end of the football stick scale, I should point out, the Lionel Messi transfer saga or non-transfer saga has kept the news hounds busy through the summer. But it's resulted in absolutely nothing happening, of course, other than a player remaining at a club where he's not happy, a president who's unpopular. I mean, Gary, you're the closest to this particular piece of action. How's this being reported on in Spain?
Jeez. There's four main sporting papers over here, Marca, AS, Deportivo and Sport. And every front page for the past 2 weeks has a picture of Messi going. But the latest headlines, Cicada is staying. I think the problem is that the argument is should Barca let Messi go for all the years he's given? He's 33 now. They've had the best years out of him. Would have been the right decision. There's an argument to say it would. The issue apparently was that Messi didn't want to take the club to legal to involve the club in a legal wrangle because it was being seemly. perhaps the argument was also that you might have lost if you had. I think somewhere down the road in the next week or so, there's going to be some kind of reconciliation between Koeman and Messi. And Messi's going to say something on the lines of, my argument was never against the club. My argument was only against the president, because there's an election due in March next year. And the odds are Bartomeu will get kicked out. And the guy who will probably, whose favourite to replace him at the moment, a guy called, I can't remember his first name, Fonte is his surname. And he has already said that if he's elected, he will sack Koeman and bring in Javier Hernandez, who's currently managing in Qatar, I think. So if you think this wrangle's over, bring on, guys, because this is going to run for a while yet.
But of course, he can leave for free next summer anyway, because that'll be the end of his contract, regardless of this current legal standoff. And I guess the question there is, Man City, obviously, they've moved, they've had discussions with him. They want him to come. Do you think that'll still be the case next year, Paul? And also, how will this alter the Premier League prospects going forward? And obviously, you're gaining the best player of his generation, or perhaps any other, arguably. You know, that's only going to strengthen that particular club, but quite how he fits in is another matter, when presumably he would have to start every single time.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Gary said before, that I think Messi's best days are behind him. And I think the other complication is whether Guardiola would be there the season after next in Man City as well. And
true.
I think... I suppose people would say, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think Man City need a different type of player to Messi. I think that they need a tall centre forward. They need someone who can offer them a plan B, an Edin Dzeko type forwards, who can maybe give them an alternative. Because when City resorts to throwing crosses in, when they often do towards the end of the games, they haven't got a tall forward at the end of it, and they just end up giving possession away. Second thing about Messi going to Manchester is, Why would you want to go there? I mean, surely you listen to Jesus Navas saying that his daughter's skin turned grey when she was living in Manchester. So that's not exactly a strong selling point. If you're using, I mean, Gary's obviously grown well accustomed to the Catalonian sunshine then. And I'm sure, you know, for Messi to give all that to go and live in Manchester, when I don't think he speaks English, to all boost his children and family into new schools, I think that's a massive, massive step for him to take at a time in his career when he doesn't need to prove himself to anybody. If I was Lionel Messi, I almost think he's got a debt of honour to go back and play the last one, two seasons in his home country, Argentina. Because if you live in Argentina, you've never seen Messi, your best footballer, play in your national league. And I think there's almost a moral obligation of him to go back and maybe play for Newell's Old Boys or Boca Juniors or River Plate or somebody, just so the Argentinian fans can see their best ever player in their own league.
There you go, you heard it here first.
I can guys, the talk was that the deal would be 2 years playing at Manchester City and then go to the MLS and play for New York City, the City franchise club in the MLS.
Yeah.
And that Messi's family would stay in Barcelona because the kid's education, as Paul pointed out, for the time he was in Manchester, and then moved to New York afterwards. That was the sort of the skeleton plan that was posited around the newspapers over here. But obviously that's all sort of vanishing area. And Paul, you know, then again, Paul makes another good point. 12 months down the road, Messi's another year older, 34, and they're talking about the money, the crazy money. We're talking about £450,000 a week. £450,000 a week for a guy who is probably 4 years past his prime. Don't get me wrong, probably the best player I've ever seen live. But as a 34-year-old guy, even if it comes in a free transfer, that's crazy money. And if for all those people who say, well, they'll make that in shirt sales, get a life, guys. Get a life.
Well, moving on then. It's now time for you guys to pick the topics. So clambering up onto your soapbox and chance to tell us about any football theme of your choice, be it a rant or something to warm the heart with positivity. So, Matthew, over to you first.
Yeah, I will talk about something we've mentioned already, super agents, because I haven't been able to stop thinking about the Matt Doherty transfer from Wolves to Spurs, because I can't make sense of it. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, and I think it speaks to like a larger problem in football when it comes to transfers. I saw someone on Twitter describe it as the Jorge Mendes transfer. Like, it's the most Jorge Mendes transfer to ever happen. Because, I mean, Doherty's a good player. I like him. And I think he did really well for Wolves. I just can't work out the sense of Wolves selling him for like a pretty menial fee in the current transfer market and to a rival team who they're probably going to be challenging or there or thereabouts to the similar sort of positions. But then when you throw in the fact that Wolves have a really strong Mendes link, Doherty's agent is Mendes. He's going to Tottenham, whose manager is Mourinho, who is represented by Mendes. It all starts to feel a bit weird. And then I thought, you know what, the smallish fee is just down to the coronavirus. It's just down to, you know, the transfer market at the minute. But then Wolves go and sign Fabio Silva for 40 million, who is clearly a very talented prospect, as anyone who has ever played Football Manager would know. But again, it's Mendes it's Mendes teams making transfers, Wolves and Porto. So it all just feels really strange to me. And I can't quite put my finger on it, but it feels like there's something a bit strange and a bit dodgy going on.
It does feel slightly like taking on two teams in Football Manager and you know, transferring from one to the other for exorbitant fee or a fraction of the going rate.
Yeah, but I think it speaks to like the role and impacts of super agents on football and how they turn transfers into this kind of toxic ultra-capitalist segment of football. But that, again, could probably fill up a whole other podcast.
We may well get to that in due course. Okay, and Gary, your turn. What have you got for us this time?
Well, first, I'd just like to absolutely agree with what Matthew said. When I saw Doherty being transferred from Wolves to Tottenham, I thought, what a crazy sell that is. And when I saw the price, I thought, are you having a giraffe here with that fee? Crazy. But, you know, who knows what goes on in the greater world of financial jiggery poker that we know nothing about. So I agree with Matthew there. I just want to argue, sometimes things are written in football. So just a little story. So in the 2014-15 season, I'm just going to talk a little bit about a club not too far away from us, Elche. Despite managing to stay in the top flight, Elche was safe from relegation 4 games before the end of the season. They became the first team ever in the history of the Spanish Primera División to be relegated to the Segunda following regulation, financial mismanagement, economic mismanagement. And in 2016-17, they were then relegated to the third level, Segunda B, which is like a regionalised league here in Spain. So that's a third tier, shall we say, but yes, it's regionalised. And they got a guy come to take over the team called Pacheta. And a 37-year-old player who'd been to Elche, was with Elche as a younger player, then played for 3 or 4 different teams. He came back called Nino, not Nino as in Fernando Torres, but Nino, that was his sort of nickname. And 2017-18, Elche were promoted back to the second level, the Segunda. They did so after defeating Villarreal's B team in the last playoff promotion place to get through back to the Segunda. And so we're back to the present season now, and this is how coronavirus affected the La Liga. So with one game to play, Elche were in seventh place, and they were just outside the promotion playoff situations, a point behind a team called, forgive my pronunciation, but Fuenlabrada, who is the little place, little town outside Madrid, where Fernando Torres was born, and at their stage, it was actually named the Fernando Torres, Estadio Fernando Torres. Elche won their last game, but Fuenlabrada's game were against a club already relegated, Deportivo La Coruña, who would have been Premier League, Premier Division champions not so long ago, was postponed because they had players, Fuenlabrada had players who were tested positive for coronavirus. And there was a massive problem here because the legal proceedings were threatened by Deportivo, who said the relegation should be cancelled. Fuenlabrada want the game postponed, and it goes on and on for weeks. And although the game was originally decided to be postponed indefinitely, which is a strange way of saying it, the league actually weakened in the end, and the game was played. And Fuenlabrada sent a team up to Galicia to play Deportivo, and that was a weakened team. But with 2 minutes to play, they were leading 1-0. And then a guy called Claudio Bueve equalised for Depor. And in injury time, Depor would award a penalty, and the same guy stepped up and scored. So Elche were back in the playoffs after being in, out of the playoffs, out, in, out, in, out. And they were back in the playoffs again as the least qualified team. They finished in sixth position. Really? In the semi-final, they played the third place team, Zaragoza. And Zaragoza had a guy called Luis Suarez, not the guy you're thinking of, but a guy from Watford on loan. He'd scored 19 goals for the club on loan through the season. But Watford refused to extend his loan period because the season had been extended so long. And Zaragoza's next highest scorer had scored 5 goals. Playing the Hartlepool first, Elche had their forward Jonathan sent off after 30 minutes and through the first half, but they doggedly defended against the best team that didn't get promoted, although they'd lost the top scorer. And the goalkeeper, a guy called Badia, was outstanding, kept the team alive. And in the return at La Romareda, it was Nino, who was now 40 years old, who scored the penalty. On his 40, he had celebrated his 40th birthday a couple of weeks earlier, inside the last 10 minutes, to put Elche within the sort of reach of the final. But 6 minutes later, a spot kick was awarded at the other end, and all of a sudden, all the hopes were gone. But a guy called Javier Alvaz, who had just been brought in the field as a substitute the last few minutes as they tried to rescue the game, tried a Penanca penalty, and Badia, the goalkeeper, just stood tall, caught the ball, and they were through to the final. And in the final, and this is crazy. The goalless game in the first home game, Elche made a 0-0 draw. So they were playing Girona, who were, again, part of the Man City franchise of clubs. Well, obviously, Girona were favourites to go through from there. But they had, this time Girona had a player sent off. But the game seemed to be heading for extra time. 6 minutes of injury time, Elche had not had a single shot on target in the entire game. 6 minutes into injury time, across the far post, was met by a guy called Per Mia, who headed the winning goal. And Elche got into the now qualified for the Primera División. And as the fixtures came out, their first game at home would be against Barcelona.
Oh, fabulous.
You think the fairy story would end there. The problem went from there, though, that because of Barcelona's Champions League, the game's been postponed anyway. But Pacheta has now left the club, and Elche have sold 5 first-team players.
Oh, no.
So you wonder where the fairy tale's going to end.
Let's have a carry on. Great story.
Magnificent story, Gary. We need to do one part of specifically you explaining the Spanish promotion and relegation system.
Oh, five pods.
Oh, that's a great story, though. That's incredible stuff. Absolutely. And then, Paul, how about you?
Yeah, just a bit of thing about the Nations League, really. I know there's conflicting opinions about this. I'm kind of one of these people who doesn't quite see the point of it. But in particular, I'm struggling to see why we're having it this season. I mean, given the fact that Euro 2020 was cancelled, I don't see why in the congested fixture list we're asking our best players to be turned off in the Nations League this season. I mean, why could it not just have been postponed for 12 months to give players a bit of a break? I would love to see what the viewing figures were like the England-Iceland game at the weekend, because I was so underwhelmed by the whole event, the whole structure. And you mentioned before about getting Gary back to do a podcast on how the Spanish promotion system works. I think we need 10 podcasts now the Nations League works, because I have no idea how it works, what the point of it is. I don't understand why Scotland are playing Israel in some sort of playoff game for Euro 2020 players. I really find the whole thing absolutely confusing. And being an old-fashioned traditionalist, I'm looking, you know, at the rugby union model of the Six Nations, and I'm thinking, you know, rather than the Nations League, well, I personally would love to see a return to the old British Championship with France added to it, so you'd have Northern Ireland, the Republic, England, Wales, Scotland and France in a football Six Nations competition, because I think I miss the matches against the home internationals. Yeah, I'd rather play Northern Ireland, play Slovenia, Slovakia, Montenegro every second week. I'd much rather have a competition where there's much more stake, and I so miss the England-Scotland games, the passion that used to arouse. Please bring those days back.
Well, in terms of the Nation League, I've already mentioned this to you, Paul, that I'm going to fight back a little bit on this one.
I do understand the logic behind it, Aidan. It's just, it doesn't do it for me.
No, and I quite agree in terms of what you're saying about this year in particular, and, well, especially this month, having an international break after a very short off-season and before the league season got going, that does seem very, very bizarre. And sending all of these elite players flying off around Europe, here, there and everywhere, when we're in the situation we're in, does seem a little off, to say the least. So I agree with you in terms of the current setup. But in terms of overall Nations League, I think it's been a huge positive. I think we've got to think a bit more internationally, and dare I say it, the bringing back the British Championship is a bygone age, in my opinion anyway. I mean, plenty of people would agree with you, Paul, I'm absolutely sure. But I think, you know, we've got to think across the levels too. For clubs at the lower down in Europe, they only ever get an absolute spanking. And for them, the chance to develop playing against teams of their own ability or closer to it is a huge plus. But equally for the clubs for the countries further up the scale in leagues A and B, to instead of having friendlies, which nobody liked, and having games against teams of roughly similar caliber, which are in a competitive environment, and simply win them and you could get the chance through to get a trophy, and that's as much as anyone needs to understand, I think. when it comes to the playoffs and so on, I know that all comes very, very murky and I don't get all of that, but in terms of the league itself, you know, they win through and you get to win a trophy or promotion or there's relegation for those who don't do well, I think that's good to get a competitive structure instead of meaningless friendlies. I think in time it'll become more of a valid tournament, in the same way that people were less than enamoured, especially in the British Isles, about World Cups, European Championships, and indeed the European Cup as well on the club front. But yeah, once these things get established, they get going. I think this does have a certain degree of merit to it, but we'll see. You know, so other tournaments just die the death quite quickly as well. So we'll see which way this one goes.
No, okay, and just to say one more thing on that. One thing that would attract me more to Nations League, and I think you would agree with me on this, is if England played the odd game away from London, because it is supposed to be a national team, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, the era when Wembley was being rebuilt, and yeah, many of them turned out to be Manchester, but equally that was obviously for sheer numbers, but equally they played all over the country. I saw them a few times up here, but they played all over, equally other stadiums in London as well at the time. And it was magnificent. The atmosphere was hugely better than it's ever been at the new Wembley, I would venture. It wouldn't be hard at all, no. But I mean, equally, if you think beyond England or Scotland or Wales, just the chance to see a competitive fixture between Germany and Spain, which, you know, may only come along once in a blue moon in actual big tournament. This gives the chance for such fixtures to become slightly more regular. France playing Croatia again soon, and games like this that, you know, the big games in a World Cup and so on, often the big teams never actually end up clashing. And this, I think, gives a way for them to actually do so slightly more regularly. But yeah, we'll see. There's plenty of people would agree with your viewpoint as well, Paul, so we'll split the difference there.
Cheers.
Anyway, there's plenty of other stuff going on at these football times as usual, and regulars will know that our latest magazine on Marseille has sold out as quick as ever, and there's another magazine in the works as we speak as well, so keep an eye for that one coming out soon. There's also various new episodes coming out on podcasts and YouTube fronts with themes ranging from South America Files, the Champions League, Marseille as well, and football in the former Soviet Union in terms of national identities in the post-Soviet era. There's all sorts of things to look out for, so we've got all sorts covered in one way or another.
Can I mention one podcast in particular?
You certainly can. I was going to bring that one up for you. Absolutely. Oh. Go ahead.
So can I just mention, myself, Stephen Scragg, and Stuart Horsfield did a brilliant podcast yesterday with Neville Southall, covers everything from politics to football. It's an absolute must listen 90 minutes. Neville has just got so many good opinions about what's going on in society and also what's going on in modern day football. Some great insights into football in the 80s. And the great thing about Neville Southall is he doesn't care what people think about him. He's not a polished, smooth media operator like Gary Lineker. He's someone who speaks from the heart. He's someone the mainstream media won't touch. And it's an absolute fascinating podcast. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, that one is going to be a must listen, absolutely. I'm very much looking forward to that one. It was just recorded yesterday, I believe, Paul.
It was.
And I'm sure that was a great experience for you as a Evertonian, speaking to possibly one of your greatest ever players and certainly one of the finest goalkeepers that the British Isles has ever produced, that's for certain.
Oh, yeah, it's been my best 90 minutes of lockdown, without a doubt. You know?
And just before we move on to online articles and so on, Matthew, you want to have a quick shout out for Marcus Rashford?
Yes, I think too often in football, negative stories take centre stage. So it's really important to talk about Marcus Rashford. Everything he's doing for children living in poverty and going without food in Britain is beyond amazing. And I think we say this on every podcast, but football is about more than just money. And Rashford is showing that. He's been genuinely inspiring.
Totally agree, Matthew. Yeah, absolutely agree.
Couldn't agree more, Matthew. Great shout, buddy.
Good stuff. Well, as always, there's plenty of great online writing on These Football Times as well. So to round things off today, as usual, I'll get each guest to flag up a recent article from the website that they particularly liked. To take the pressure off the rest of the guys first, I'll crack on first. And mine, I've gone for a great piece by Stephen Bell, looking at football played by the prisoners on Robben Island in South Africa during apartheid. Now, I've been fortunate enough to visit Robben Island, and I could picture the scene, the location, and so on. I'm not saying at all that's necessary to get a picture of the scene that he's describing here, because it's really well told. It makes the story really come alive, and how the prisoners develop from this shared interest and into a fully structured football league that came along after. And with such activities that were initially banned and so on, it's a fascinating tale of how football gave a brief glimpse of normality and hope to those spending years incarcerated there, suffering hard labour, isolation and all that. So it's a truly excellent article and really, really good read. So that one I would heartily recommend. But Gary, have you picked one for us as well?
I certainly have. James Kelly wrote a really great article, I think, about Gianfranco Zola returned to Cagliari. After leaving Chelsea, Chelsea were in financial trouble just before Roman turned up with the rubles, and he'd agreed to go back to Cagliari, the club he'd started with. And when Abramovich moved into the club, there was money there to pay him, and they offered him a new contract. But being the sort of guy that he was, he said he couldn't because he'd given his word he would go back to Cagliari. And James tells the story of his return to Cagliari wonderfully. It's a great article. I was well impressed with it as a Chelsea fan. Great stuff, James. Well done, mate.
Perfect one for you, I'm sure, there, Gary. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, Paul, then how about you?
Yeah, the one I picked is by Ada Williams. I don't know if you two relate or not, Aidan, but
I'll take credit for it, but no.
He puts it all down to you, to be fair. But it's about George Rayner, you know, who many people might not be aware, but he was the first English manager to take a team to a World Cup final when he was manager of Sweden in 1958. And it's just a fascinating story how someone who's obviously so successful on the international front couldn't get a job back in England. The only job he could get back in England was managing Skegness at the time, because no football league team would touch him. And it's always, to me, I love these what-if moments in football. In 1953, when England got beat 6-3 by Hungary, the month before, an amateur Sweden team managed by George Rayner had drawn with Hungary 2-2. And George Rayner sent a report into the FA, making them aware of how to play against Hungary, what tactics to use. No, the FA read it because they thought, well, they can't be that good because you couldn't beat an amateur Sweden team. And you just can't believe that the pig-headedness of some of the officials in charge at that time. And it's one of those what-if moments. What if George Rayner had been appointed England manager for the 1954 World Cup? What if the Munich air disaster never happened? Could England have won the World Cup in 1958?
Excellent pick. That's really, really interesting. The George Rayner thing, it's a really, really great subject. I found it quite interesting looking into some of that parts of football history for various things. And yeah, you're right. He sort of developed the tactics to which proved to nullify the great Hungarians, at least to an extent. But England utterly ignored that. And even then, of course, on the back of that 6-3 defeat, England then went to Hungary and got walloped 7-1. So they didn't even learn their own lessons, never mind from anybody else. Interesting stuff. And Matthew, over to you. What have you chosen for us this time?
Yeah, I've chosen one of Mr. Thacker's articles about Il Gol di Torone. Do you remember a time back when, about 15 years ago, you used to be able to buy really cheap random European shirts from Soccer Sports? Or the first non-Birmingham City shirt I owned was a Roma shirt with Montella on the back. And so, like, ever since then, I've had a soft spot for Roma, and I adore Italian football, which I think is like the most interesting footballing nation because of incidents like this. You have like a controversial offside goal that practically seals the title for Juventus, but is seen by the rest of the country as further proof of bias officials have towards Juve, which may or may not be true. Amazing. More please. Like the culture drama and general controversy that happens almost weekly in Italian football is addictive. So yeah, really enjoyed this article.
Fantastic.
Appreciate that, mate. Thank you.
Great choice. Well, there's plenty more all of those came from, of course, so do check out the treasure trove of writing we've got online. But we'll wrap up there for today. So all that remains is to thank my guests for making it such a good discussion. Gary, thanks as always. And before you go, a quick comment on Chelsea's impressive summer recruitment.
I tell you what, mate, it ain't bad, is it really? I mean, you know, we hadn't bought anybody for two transfer windows, but and they had the money for the Hazard transfer to Real Madrid in the bank. But I'm looking forward to this season. Fantastic, fantastic.
See if you can close the gap on those above. We'll see.
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath yet. But, you know, I mean, it's probably the best transfer window I can remember. And thanks for inviting me on. It's been a great chatting with the guys, and good fun as always.
Thanks very much. And Paul, thanks for your terrific insights once again. And Everton too have been rather active in the transfer window. So looking forward to joining in the salsa dancing with James Rodriguez this coming season, are you?
Espero que sí. Es un jugador fantástico, ¿no? Yes.
Muy bien, muy bien, amigo.
Sorry. But yeah, I mean, as ever with Everton, I mean, Alan has definitely signed. You know, there's always that 1% doubt with Everton that they get these signings over the line. I mean, nobody can think about when we had the Brazilian Muller who was about to sign, put pen to paper until you realise his salary was going to be taxable, not non-taxable, and then stormed out the building. So cautiously optimistic. Yeah, and I think Ancelotti has used his charisma and his experience to Mingham players who he knows well, who he can trust. And I'm glad that for once we've gone for experience rather than trying to buy people who may have ability but never actually deliver.
Certainly make Everton an interesting one to watch this year. That's absolutely certain. Yep. And Matthew, thank you too. And great to have you on once again. Signing international stars isn't for the likes of you and me, though. I don't think our clubs are a bit more basic in their transfer dealing. So how are Birmingham shaping up ahead of the new season?
This is a safe space. We don't need to talk about no, it's been all right. We've got a new manager in Ita Karanka, who I think I trust more than who we've had in like recent years. The transfers have all been sensible, I think, which is, again, we haven't done that in a while. But then we went and lost to Cambridge 1-0 in the Carabao Cup yesterday. So again, we don't need to talk about Blitz. But thanks for having me on. It's been a fascinating talk as always.
Oh, great. Thanks very much. And thanks to all our listeners, of course. So please join us again next month for another discussion on today's Football Times. But for now, thanks for listening, and we'll speak next time. Thanks and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.